The only difference between me and a lot of other people is that I do not fear failure and I push through the dip.
You know, I started this whole thing. This is our 15th episode, and this is the second one you've been on. Thank you. But I think
Am I the first repeat?
you are the first repeat guest, and I think I know the first person that you're going to gloat to about that. But we'll leave that.
Yeah, I totally was just going to say, can we give a shout out to Casey and make sure she knows I'm the first repeat guest.
You just did. But I started this with almost a sense of like superiority about how crude the technology was. Like,
yes.
But the more I do it, the more like I want the audio quality to be better. So, well, and I've got more tools than I had before. So we'll see how it goes. But I'm still just doing these over with a Google Hangout. And so, okay. Anyway, let's dive right in. We don't have an unlimited amount of time. So
well, actually, I mean that's a really good. I mean, knowing that you want to talk about the confirmation stuff and the Theocademy stuff in general, I mean, yeah. that's a really good segue because part of our MO, part of our aesthetic has been, look, we're going to work with what we have. You know, we started out with a really basic entry-level consumer HD camcorder, and I had a rudimentary USB mic that I threw up on an old live performance microphone boom stand, and I just, you know, recorded it onto my laptop and just I was really proud of the crap I was working with because it was, I've always said, it's not the tools that make the artist. It's the artist that makes the artist. The tools are just literally tools, and so you work with what you've got. And too many people try to think that what they need to do is have all the best tools in the world when they don't even know what they're doing. You now have an exponentially greater level of understanding about what it takes to record audio because you started out with just bare bones equipment and bare bones software.
Well, has your equipment advanced since you started then? Have you invested in better equipment?
Oh, yeah. So we started out with one, like I said, one handheld consumer camera that I put up on a tripod that I owned that I actually got off of eBay for like next to nothing. I was using all of my old, I mean, literally, Rocky, this is the equipment that I had when we were in college doing Jesus Fish. I mean, it's still that same stuff.
Wait a minute. Jesus Fish, for people Jesus. Who don't know, and I don't know how you wouldn't know.
was my college rock band.
The college rock band of Sterling, Kansas in the late 90s. Like, I mean, they were known from, like, Sterling to, like, you know, parts of Lion.
Like, we got into Heston once.
I think there might have been like two people in Hutchinson who were down. But anyway, you started out with the same equipment you had then.
Yeah. And then once we put out a product, I mean, we just started making stuff and we put out a product and we worked with the limitations we had. So the camera that I had was not great. The camera wasn't from Jesus Fish days. The camera was from early on in my time with the Synod. So it was a three or four year old camera. And the reason why the early Theocademy videos, part of them were in black and white, is because I had a horrible camera and I didn't want to have to take the time to, I would have been spending more time doing color correcting than anything. So I just flipped it all into black and white and kind of made that my aesthetic and just worked within the limitations that I had. But now I've got a full professional boom stand that's weighted for my microphone. I spent a couple $100 on the boom stand alone for the microphone. I've got a bank of lights. I've got professional grade tripods for three DSLR cameras that I record with. I've got a studio set up. I've got multiple editing computers, one for audio, one for video. Simply because we started and we just built, you know, a minimum viable product and threw it out there and people responded and it allowed us to know what we needed to do and how we needed to get better. So, I mean, it's the same kind of thing you're working on. You're discovering, you know, the crudeness of what you've got and knowing when you need to upgrade your equipment and your software, you know what kind of upgrades you need to make.
All right, so I want to ask you about the minimum viable product, because that's a phrase I've heard you use before. I think it comes from the Lean Startup. Is that right?
Yeah, Eric Ries's book.
Okay, so it's basically just get something off the ground, the bare minimum you need to see whether or not you actually have something and just start doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it takes the whole long tail idea. Well, not the long tail idea. The consumer curve. You know, you've got your early adopters, your cutting edge people, your early adopters, your first mass, then your late adopters. The minimum viable product are the people who are going to love what you're doing anyway. And so you started the Yo Rocco podcast by promoting it to people who love your work anyway. And you put this thing out there, and it was bare bones. It was minimum. It was the minimum viable product you could produce in order to demonstrate to someone what you were talking about.
Right.
And then you started getting feedback. And so part of the feedback you've gotten is, hey, you know, could you control the audio a little more? Aha, now I can tweak and I can pivot a little bit and I can do some things. I've also noticed, you know, you've had a bit of a shift in some of your thematic content. You started out talking to people who were doing interesting things apart from the church. And then you started, I assume, started getting feedback from folks that, hey, I'd really like to hear about this or that. That was interesting. Do more of that. And so you've widened your thematic content. I mean, today we're ostensibly talking about the work I'm doing with our new confirmation series. That's absolutely 100% a part of the church. And so that minimum viable product gives people an opportunity to basically test in real time, with rapid iteration, what a particular audience might want.
But the thing for me that's is that it was not a thematic decision for me in terms of, okay, the minimum viable product now needs to pivot thematically. It's just you commit to doing something once a week and you say publicly you're going to do it once a week and it's content-based, then you have to have someone to talk to every week. And so I have been I've been including people who I know. I don't know if you're facing the same kind of thing with Theo Academy, and I want to get into a fuller kind of description of Theo Academy for people who aren't familiar with it. But, you know, you publicly go out there and say, I'm doing this thing, and you're committed to making it work, and you're committing to making it better. So let me ask you about the response that you've gotten from people, because you said you changed the technology based on what you heard from people. How are you getting response from people? I'm interested in what people have said to you, but I'm more interested in the mechanism you have for getting feedback.
The mechanism is really rudimentary at this point. One of the things that I really need to work on is a better feedback system. How do I hear from people what they're doing in a much more rapid way? Most of the time it's anecdotal, and I've tried to employ those best practices of making sure there's a saved search in my Twitter search bar for Theo Academy. So anytime anybody mentions Theo Academy, I can see a stream of what people are talking about. A lot of people are just really gracious. And when people say, hey, I'm looking for a curriculum for new members, or I'm looking for a curriculum for confirmation on Facebook, people will say, hey, check out this Theo Academy project that Landon's working on, and they'll tag me in it. And so I'll be able to see the conversation. For the most part, that's how I'm getting the feedback right now, because we don't have a really good feedback system. That's kind of the next, if we're going to take a jump, if Theo Academy is going to take a jump as a project, as an organization, that I think is the audience interface is going to have to be the next major focus of our work.
Is the issue feedback, or is the issue interacting with the people who are using the thing you're making?
I think it's what I really care about is feedback. What I care about is it working or is it not? And in fact, this week was the very first time I released the first set of Theo Academy videos. So a brief history of Theo Academy videos. We've been on a 2-year plan for non-Presbyterians. This is a little bit of Presbyterian speak. We've got a group of people called commissioned ruling elders. They're not full seminary trained pastors, but they're people who serve as pastors, and the training for them is really inconsistent across our church. So I wanted to develop a training program for those folks that would be consistent across the church. the people who get to be these commission ruling elders are people who serve on our local church boards. They're called ruling elders. And so if we were going to do that end goal, we had to back up and do the first goal and make sure that people were trained well to do that. And if we were going to get good candidates to be our church board members, our ruling elders, then we needed to have good new members. So we did a series for new members. So we've been on a year and a half long trek to get to what is our ultimate goal. A little over a year ago, we released the 5 videos for our new members series. And then coming up this summer will be a year that we released our training videos for ruling elders, for our church board members. Up until then, we've not really been doing anything, because all we've been trying to do is just get content out there and make good content and try to do a volume of work and try to get what we're doing out. So the feedback that we've gotten has been, people say, hey, these first 2 video series, they're great, but you know what we really need is we really need confirmation. I mean, that's why we're making a confirmation series, is because people said, what we really need is this. These are fun and these are fine, but I need this thing. And actually, for the very first time this week, I got some feedback from folks. Oh, I remember the question. I got some feedback from folks where people basically said, we used, you know, one set of these videos and they didn't really connect. And so I just kind of posted on this Facebook feed that I was tagged on and said, hey, if there's something glaring, please let me know. I don't know when I'd be able to reshoot it, but if enough people are naming something that is not working or is wrong, then I want to make sure and correct that. But a lot of it's just been, a lot of it at this stage is, I mean, it's still those early adopters. It's people who care. It's people who are going to care about the work that I'm doing anyway, because they're my friends or I've developed a different relationship with them in the church, you know, a good relationship, working relationship with them in the church. These are people who are going to care about what I'm doing. And so the feedback they're offering is not your typical, you know, hashtag at the giant corporation, you know, your barista, hey, Starbucks, your barista, you know, stiffed me. It's, you know, it's people like you who I know who say, hey, I think the thing you're working on is really good. I can see where you're going. Here are some things that you could do to make it better. That's the kind of feedback that I get right now. I'm trying to figure out, how do we make sure that the person who doesn't know me can offer really good feedback? Because that's the next wave of people that I need to be serving, not just my friends who are going to support me in whatever I'm doing anyway.
I've taught confirmation for 7 or 8 years now, and there's no shortage of material out there. What do you think they're asking for from Theo Academy that they can't already get?
I think there's 2 things, or maybe 3 things. There's the reality that at the time, a lot of the stuff that we were putting out was 100% free, and so they're looking for ways to stretch their curriculum budget, and so they liked what we put out. They could see the benefit of something like that, and it's not going to cost them anything. We're actually going to charge for our Theo Academy series, but it's going to be an extremely negligible cost. So it's as close as free as we can make it without it actually being free. So I think part of it was they were hoping for something that wasn't going to cost them anything.
So wait. Confirmation, you are going to charge for that.
We are going to charge. We are going to charge for the series. Okay. We've had a lot of internal staff conversation about that, because you know my MO as a guy who pushes open source stuff, you know, I want to give away as much as I possibly can. But the reality is if we're going to keep producing good quality material for the church, we have to develop some sort of dependable, sustainable revenue so that we can keep doing. So we think we've priced it right so that it's not gouging people by any stretch. But it'll allow us to seed the next project that we'll work on.
So what will it cost?
Right now, what we're looking at is there are 17 videos. I'm gonna load 5 of them on YouTube for free. So you'll know what you're getting. One thing I hate is when I have to pay for something and I have no idea what I'm getting. You know, with an old school bookstore, I could walk into the bookstore, I could thumb through the book, I could read a little bit of it. I knew what I was getting before I made a purchase. So we're going to put 5, you know, roughly a third of the series on YouTube for absolutely free. Then we're going to have a one-time digital download pack of all 17 videos and their accompanying study guides for $20. It's a one-time cost, and it'll be Creative Commons licensed. So, you know, pay this fee, download this digital pack, make as many copies for as many years as you want to. You own it. You do what you want to with it. If you want to buy physical DVDs, we're going to sell a set of those for $40.
So you've got DVD sales on the website right now for the new member and the officer training one, right?
Yeah, yeah. They've actually been pretty good considering that we give all of those videos away for free. I've actually been shocked. We've paid for our production cost of making the DVDs, not the full production cost. That both of those sets of videos cost almost $30,000 to produce. So we're not making back that money, but we had not originally factored in DVD sales, and so that was an extra cost that we did after we built the budget, and we've managed to make that a cost neutral affair. So I'm really pleased, and people are so gracious to recommend it, and people keep buying.
I don't understand why people are buying the DVDs though. I mean, it's free online.
You know, we had this conversation as part of our staff meeting when we were trying to decide what we were going to do as far as our pricing structure for confirmation. It makes sense to me that you would say that. You and I are of the same generation. You and I are of the same technological savviness as far as, consuming content from the internet. But one of the things that is real is that there are, of the 10,500 plus Presbyterian churches, a lot of those are in rural areas where maybe the internet is still not as strong as it needs to be. So streaming is not a real conducive, viable option. Maybe a church doesn't have Wi-Fi in their Sunday school classroom, that kind of thing.
Logical snob.
So for a lot of them, what the technology that they know is, they've got the media cart. And literally, probably 5, maybe 6 years ago, that media cart had a DVD player added to it, as opposed to the VHS player that they had for the last 15, 20 years. And so that's the medium that they know how to work with. And so my assumption is, and again, this is the kind of feedback that I really need in order to know what kind of service we can provide for folks is, what their technological setup. But my assumption is that these are a lot of pastors who are, A, just comfortable with that medium, and B, it fits the technology that they have available to them to work with. I think another thing is that we're making a video series with an attendant study guide, not a booklet with supplemental video. So the main thing of this whole thing is video, and that's the lingua franca right now. That's what people are using. That's the way we consume content a lot of the time right now. So it was interesting to them. And it works well for that kind of thing. I think some of what we're doing is that I am known as a progressive person, a progressive theological person. That's fun for me because I've actually worked really hard, and I think that we've succeeded. I've worked really hard at making sure that this was not a progressive educational series. Because I want this to be a series for the whole church. I mean, the Synod of Mid-America that I work for and who I am primarily accountable to is not a dramatically progressive place. We're pretty average in the Presbyterian Church. We're center or slightly center left. So I can't go off crazy and talk about all the theological theories that I like. I have to make sure that it matches. The people that I am primarily accountable to. And so the study guide writer that I hired, our friend Jody, who is
Jody Craiglow,
probably one of the most, Jody Craiglow. She's an inspiration to me. She is self-identified. I don't know that she would use these exact terms, but she is self-identified on the right or on the conservative or on the traditional end of the church. Unbelievably, she has more of a desire and a gift to try to find common ground with people than anybody that I've ever met. And so between Jody and I think we've done a really good job at hitting a middle ground. And she has said that she's gotten word from her friends, people that she knows in the more conservative side of our church, who have spoken very well of the work that we've done. So I feel like we've hit a really good middle ground. So, but ultimately, I think people were doing it because they thought, oh, this is going to be a more progressive thing. I hope what they're finding is this is a very balanced Presbyterian thing.
Yeah.
But I think the main reason, and this is what I'm banking on, the main reason why people were asking for a confirmation series when there are, you know, a whole host of them out there, not the least of which because it's free, because it's video based, and because it's more progressive, at least that's their perception. I think it fits the need of it's easy. I mean, I'm giving them a turnkey situation here. They don't have to sit down and come up with what do these kids need to learn. I think it's hilarious that in the Presbyterian Church, pastors are we're sometimes called teaching elders. We don't get a whole lot of instruction on how to teach and how to build curriculum. This is a place where our certified Christian educators are, you know, kicking our tails on a lot of this stuff. But for the most part, what we're offering them is a well thought out, logical, faithful to our tradition, a scope and sequence. That's a publishing term. The scope and sequence of what we're doing. We're saying, here's what we think kids need to learn. If it wasn't free video and had the sheen of being progressive, that may not matter as much, but I think that those are the reasons why they were saying, hey, we'd like for you to do something for us. And plus, it's the new thing. I mean, honestly, Rocky, that's a lot of it. It's the new thing. It's sexy for right now. It's probably the only place in my life where I'm considered sexy.
The sexiest confirmation curriculum out there. Well, the other new-ish video-based confirmation thing that's available is the stuff that Sparkhouse has produced. And that, you know, that's a mainline denominational publishing entity, and it's targeted to mainline denominational churches doing confirmation.
Right.
But, it's night and day from what you're going to do. Obviously, Sparkhouse has a whole staff of people. Those videos are animated. I can imagine their budget is three times what you've got to work with.
Right.
But even the philosophical underpinning of what you're doing, you know, those I've used those Sparkhouse videos, and they're great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really are.
They are. It's a lot of tongue in cheek. It's a lot of sort of random based humor to try to get into the subject with teenagers. Now, I've seen the things you've posted on Facebook about the scripts for this, and I know from what you've posted that we should expect a lot of nerdy pop culture references. Before Zahad, which I had to look up, by the way, that's how much out of the loop I am. I mean, how much are you going to? How geared are these thematically and just in their tone towards adolescence? And how serious are they?
I love that question. We intend for them obviously to be geared towards. To be geared towards adolescence, to be geared towards youth. We want the language to be, if we use a $10 seminary word, we make fun of ourselves for using it. Or we acknowledge there's a fancy word. We use that phrase several times and through the course of the videos. The fancy word for this is this, but here's what we're talking about when we mean that. So we try to have the language be such that, you know, a 12 to 16-year-old girl or boy is going to recognize the words that we're using. We try not to use any highfalutin language. I've posted on Facebook some of the pop culture references that I've used, but in truth, they're purely illustrative and purely meant to just help them hook. So at one point, we're talking about the Theological Declaration of Barman. And we note that it was written in the 1930s during the Nazi regime in Germany. And so we just do a little aside. I have the host do a little aside and say, hey, you remember Hydra from the Captain America movie? Yeah, Hydra worked for the Nazis. That's who we're talking about. It's really as simple as that. It's just a little hook for something that they've seen, and they recognize this group of people in these weird uniforms. Those are the people that we're talking about. That's the time period in which this confession was written.
Okay, so you're using a popular movie that all the teenagers would know, just as a way of making an illustration.
Yeah, yeah, and we do get serious. I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's heavy. I wouldn't say it's somber, and we try not to be overly academic. But we, I mean, we get serious a couple of times. I mean, you know, when we talk about God's providence, you know, one of the part of the script is the host looks directly at the camera and says, "I'm going to get serious for a second. Here are some situations in life." And you can imagine that people who are in those situations might be questioning whether or not God actually cares about them. So we do try to name some of the things. One of the things that I have been told that I do well when it comes to speaking with youth is being able to name what they might be thinking. And so we try to put some of that stuff in there. We've had a handful of teenagers read the stuff, and they've said, "Yeah, this makes sense to us. This works, and we can see where you're going, and we like where you're going."
All right. So you've mentioned a host a couple times. You're not the face on the screen for these?
No, I am not. I am the writer, producer, director, but you won't ever see me. A young woman. Her name is Jessie Light. She is a member of one of our presbyteries, Heartland Presbyteries. She's a student at Austin Seminary right now, just completed her first year at Austin Seminary. She was the associate youth director at one of our churches here in Kansas City. Part of my conviction was that if Theo Academy was going to have a chance, it needed to have a couple things happen. It needed to not be as intimately tied to my face, so that
nothing about your face, but I mean,
I got a great face for radio. It couldn't always be me. So I needed to have somebody else. I was convicted that it needed to be a young adult, someone who is more relatable, I felt, to youth than I am. I don't think I'm unrelatable, but I wanted to hedge my bets.
You act like a teenager most of the time.
Right. You know, but I'm pushing 40, dude, right? I mean, you know, there comes a time where, you know, Jessie's 24. I mean, there's just some things that there's a way of being about her that is absolutely, I mean, she's very cool. I guess I'll say it that way. She's very cool.
I don't doubt that, but I'm pushing 40 as well. And I still, you know, I'm a youth pastor. I get nervous. Good. So clearly there are advantages to having, you know, somebody like Jessie be the face and the voice addressing teenagers, because that's the audience. How much did you coach Jessie in kind of what you wanted in terms of a posture and an affect, and how much did you just kind of turn her loose to do her thing? And has she done this kind of thing before?
She has not formally done this before. She's had some performance experience, but she's not. She doesn't have a long history of performance like I do. So what I tried to do is, I mean, you hear directors talk about this all the time. You just try to get really good actors and then just kind of turn them loose to do their thing and try to give them as minimal instruction as possible. Because if you don't have a good actor, why did you hire them in the first place? So my convictions were, I needed somebody younger. I needed a woman. I felt very strongly that this could not be a man. There's enough male faces out there. If we had somebody in our synod that we could afford to bring in, who was not white, I would have gone that direction as well. I also wanted to look for somebody that had experience either in performance or working with youth, and Jessie kind of fit the majority of the characteristics that I was looking for that were local enough that it wouldn't bust my budget to fly them in and put them up for several days. She was coming home after her semester was over. She was coming home, so it worked out really well. And we just got done filming actually yesterday. We filmed for 2 days, and she did really well. She was better than I even hoped that she would be. She had inflections that were different than mine, but there were a few times where I was like, okay, let's do that again. And I want you to do this line and, you know, a little more sing-songy. And I'd demonstrate what I'd want, and she'd do that for me. She was a really, really easy to work with. So it didn't require a whole lot on my end. The only things that I really had to work with her on were basic things that everybody who has, or anybody who's never done video before, you know, just wouldn't think about as a natural part of the thing. Like, you know, make sure you've got kind of a smile on your face the whole time. I know we're talking about serious things, but you got to look like you're, You know, you got to look like you're kind of happy most of the time. You know, so just reminding her, hey, make sure you got your smiling eyes going. Those kinds of things. I mean, it was really a dream situation as far as that was concerned.
And that's a really different relationship for you with the relationship for you to the content. I mean, you have been the voice. I mean, you've been the one talking to people through this. It's been your project, and this seems to me like you're giving over the Theo Academy name to somebody else. You're directing them and you're producing what they're doing, but it sounds to me like it was important to you that it not be tied to your face anymore. But still, knowing you, that must have been difficult.
It was, yeah, absolutely. I tried to be very open, and I said to her, listen, I wrote this. I'm a 38-year-old Midwestern white guy. I've got a limited scope. I've got a way that I talk. I think I've approximated a voice well. I mean, I wrote with you in mind. But if you need to say something a little different than the way that I would say it, go ahead and do that. If it's a substantive change, theological substance, let's talk about it and make sure that you're comfortable saying what I'm having you say.
So did she actually do that? Did she change some things?
She didn't change anything substantive. She thought that based on what she understood about what we were talking about, that we were hitting the money right on. There were several points where we talked about some issues of oppression and marginalization that before we recorded, I said, I want you to read this section. I want you to tell me, is this right? Is there another way we need to be saying this? I mean, I said to her a couple different times, I've never been oppressed in my life. I don't know what I'm talking about from experience. I'm just repeating what I've heard. So you tell me, is this right? I mean, at one point we talked about some issues of gender harassment, and I said, this is not my experience. Is this right? She goes, yeah, this works. I think this is right on the money. I was like, okay, well let's roll with it. At one point I had her say a line, I've never been in a theological mosh pit, and she looked at me, she goes, I can't say this, that's a lie. I actually have been in a theological mosh pit. I'm like, you're ridiculous. But for the most part, yeah, I mean, it was a really good experience for me giving over, and I appreciate the way you've named it, giving over this thing to somebody, trusting someone else with this brand that I've tried to carefully cultivate over the last 2 years, giving it over to someone who held it with care and treated it with the same respect that I treated it with. It was a really wonderful experience. And I feel that way. I'm working with a couple other people. Like you mentioned Eric Clark a while ago. Eric is doing a series for me. I have zero control. I mean, I have literally just commissioned a series of videos from him. And he likewise has treated the Theo Academy brand with as much care as what I am treating it. Talking with a couple other people about doing some stuff, and I want to use their voice and their perspective. You know, some friends of ours that you know. I don't want to name names because we don't have that finalized yet. But these are folks who have a fundamentally different perspective than I do, but they are going to care for this thing in the same way that I feel like I'm caring for it.
Well, I like that. I like that we're sort of divulging or trying not to divulge secrets on that podcast. It feels very important all of a sudden. You must write these differently when you know someone else is going to be speaking.
This is the first time that I've written for someone else. So like one of the other ones, I contacted, she's an African-American woman, and I said, I think that you have a voice and you have a perspective that is so affirming of what it means to be a Christian. It calls Christians to a really great place. I want to figure out how to do something with you. I don't know what it is. And so she and I have been going back and forth trying to figure that out. But when time comes to put pen to paper or, you know, fingers to keyboard, I'm going to trust her to write it because it's going to be her voice. It's going to be her thing. That's going to be another step for me. I'm not actually going to be the one to do the writing, but I trust her enough to know that when the time comes, she understands what we're doing, and she will treat it with the same care that I'm treating it with.
So is anybody editing these scripts that you're writing?
No. Right now it's just me kind of flying by the seat of my pants. I spent the last 2 weeks before Memorial Day frantically writing scripts I had my staff read them. I had Jesse read them. Jesse's the host of the Confirmation series. We had some teenagers read them. They offered some feedback, but nobody really edited them in a traditional editing sense, like the way that you edited with me on Pilgrim. There's been nothing like that.
Right. And Pilgrim is a magazine that we did 4 issues of a few years ago that was long form writing and stuff like that. It was really fun. Writing a script for a video series is not something you are quote unquote trained to do. Like most of the things I've known you to work on, you just kind of have the gumption start and say, yeah, I could do this, and then you figure it out along the way. How does writing scripts for videos rate in terms of, you know, the learning curve and the difficulty compared to the other things that you've done, from, you know, like publishing a magazine, and you had a podcast a while ago, and things like that? How hard is writing a video script compared to those other things in terms of just learning how to do it as you go?
For me, it's been a lot easier, actually. When we were in college, I took a script writing class. I was a theater major, and so I took a script writing class. And while that was hard then, because I had no experiences, no knowledge, I mean, I was a 19-year-old kid. I didn't have jack squat to draw on to write a script. The process has actually been easier. So I've done a couple different forms of writing. So I've written blog posts, and, you know, we generally know what the accepted form of blog post writing is. And it's similar to like a magazine article. There's a similar kind of thing, depending on the length of what you're doing. So we all kind of understand what that format looks like. I've written a book. That's another particular kind of writing. You've got to be very precise. You not that you don't choose words careful on these other things, but unlike a blog post, I can't take my book down. I mean, the book is in print. It's out there. People are thankfully still buying it. So you have to write. You have to write evergreen language for posterity, and especially given the audience that I was writing for, primarily pastors and seminary professors and seminary students, you had to affect a certain kind of vocabulary that you were using. I tried my hand at fiction, and that was, of all the things that I've done, that's the most difficult thing that I've done. I wrote a 20,000 word novella that was intended to be the first of a series. I think it went well. The editor that I worked with was really helpful and really gracious to me and helped me out a lot. But the thing that was problematic with that for me was all the descriptive language. I'm an introvert, so I'm a watcher. People may not believe this, but I'm not really a describer. I don't describe. I like to talk about ideas. I like to talk about ethereal things, not things that actually exist. So when I'm moving into writing scripts for a video series, I found it to be the perfect match of all the things that I like to do. I could write in a conversational voice because that's what we were trying to do. I didn't have to worry about describing the setting. I didn't have to worry about describing the backstory. I didn't have to worry about describing a particular character's I could just write the words, and that was enough. And I knew enough to say, okay, I've got a couple different cameras that I'm working with. So when she says this, I want her looking at camera one. When she says this, I want her looking at camera two. But beyond that, I didn't really concern myself too much with it.
Okay.
I have an assistant producer actually who then took the scripts. A member of my staff took the scripts, worked through them, and helped me to work out, okay, here's what we need to have in the set. So she played props mistress for the whole thing. And that was really helpful. Jesse, you know, added in some things. I actually really liked writing the scripts a lot.
Good. That's one of the things that I'm really interested in talking to all these different people I'm talking to on the podcast is, what are they really interested in working on? I mean, most of these people that I'm talking with are working on projects that arise from something they're passionate about or curious about at the very least, and they're kind of working that out through a project. And I mean, that it doesn't surprise me that that it's the same way for you with writing these video scripts. But, you know, I've known you for quite a while, and you're a guy who jumps into lots of different new projects and plays around with lots of different medium. And you start more projects than anybody I know.
That way I know which ones work and which ones don't.
Well, what I was going to say is that you don't seem to suffer from the same kind of trepidation that me and lots of other people I know suffer from, where we think, hey, we should do this thing, but we're never going to actually do it because of the fear of it not working, or not, you know, the anxiety about starting something when you don't have all the answers in place ahead of time stops most of us from trying these things. You start more projects than anyone I know, and you therefore you have a longer list of projects that have been abandoned than anyone I know.
That's right.
The Neo Academy is probably the thing that I've known you to work on the longest.
Yeah.
Why is that? Like, why is Theo Academy stuck?
Yeah, oh, I like the way you put that. So probably a number of things. I adopted a few years ago the Silicon Valley startup mantra of fail fast, fail often, fail forward. That's how I run the Synod. That's what I tell my staff. I don't care if you fail. What I care about is if it took you 3 weeks to fail when it should have taken you 3 hours to fail. That's what I care about. We're all going to fail. And so a lot of the culture that I, well, that we, you and I mean, that we deal with in the church is a culture of fear of failure. There's nothing wrong with it. Let's try something. That's why I also talk about how I've got a lot of ideas. You know, hey, I've got a really good idea, because an idea can be changed. You know, you can abandon an idea. It was just an idea. You can try it out. I think the reason that Theo Academy has stuck is because it is a culmination point for me of a lot of different things that I'm interested in. I've wanted to be a performer for a long time. You know, way back in 1985, when Jon Bon Jovi, you know, had "Living on a Prayer" on the radio, I was in my dad's garage with a broom.
Stop.
Yeah, no, seriously, I was in the garage with a broom, pretending like I was Jon Bon Jovi singing "Living on a Prayer." I wanted to be a performer. I came to college intending to be a professional actor. While I was at college, that kind of shifted, and I wanted to be a director. I found that I really enjoyed directing a lot more than I liked being an actor. I have always had big ideas and have wanted to communicate those ideas. So I learned how to communicate ideas. I tried to be a writer for a long time. I went to seminary because I actually went to seminary. I may have never told you this, but my impetus for going to seminary, actually, my justification for going to seminary was actually something you said when you were deciding. No, it is. It totally is. Because you said to me, you said, I don't know what I want to do, but what I do know is that the church is the organization I want to live my life through.
Yeah, man, that was that's Robert Bella language, the habits of the heart and the good society. It's the institutional, like, what institution gets your time and your energy? Yeah, I totally remember that.
Yeah, I think we were standing in a parking lot.
Oh, man.
After the rehearsal dinner of your wedding, and we were talking about Bart. I think hadn't you just finished your first year of seminary at that point?
I had.
Yeah, and so we were talking about calling and all this kind of stuff. It was a group of us. I think Brian was with us as well. And that's what you said, and I was like, oh, that makes total sense. I have no idea what I want to do, but I know the church is the institution I want to live my life through. So I went to seminary, and as I told you on the last time we talked, you know, I went thinking I was going to learn theology in order to write music for the church. And so for me, Theo Academy is kind of, I've always looked for that niche where I could kind of make a mark. So now I'm going to be really vulnerable and engender a lot of, or invite a lot of ridicule. So when I went for my psychological evaluation, which is something all Presbyterian candidates for ministry have to go through.
Right. Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah. So when I went to my psychological evaluation, as I was doing like the final wrap up with the psychologist, he said, you got a pretty healthy ego there. I was like, yeah, I do. He goes, he said, what's your ultimate goal with being in ministry? I said, I don't know. I said, forgive this language, but all I know is that I want to affect masses of asses for Jesus. That was my words to him. So I've been looking for opportunity. That's what I do. I don't do anything small, at least long term. I do the small thing because I know that there's something there that I need to learn, and it's valuable to do in and of itself. I don't want to say I use things as stepping stones, But I think the reason Theocademy is stuck is that it's a wide enough reach. It's affecting a lot of people, thankfully, thanks be to God. It draws on all of my skills that I've developed up to this point. It's challenging. And so that's thrilling to me. I mean, there are things that I don't know. Like, for instance, this Theocademy series is going to have three parts. It's going to have this host. It's going to have a little bit of animated bit, which I'm going to have to figure out. And it had interviews between youth and their pastors. I lost a good bit of one major interview. I was literally laying on the floor crying because I lost this. Because I don't know the workflow of doing a production this size. I didn't back things up appropriately. I'm just struggling through this and trying to figure out how do I put out a good quality product and screwing up along the way.
So you totally lost it. It's you can't recover it at all.
I cannot recover it at all. There were 17 different sections and I lost 13 of the 17 sections.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, I'm devastated. I'm having to tell these people that I have lost your video. Is going to be a very not fun conversation. I mean, I paid them for their time. You know, they didn't do this for free. They didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart. But, you know, when you've got a youth who expects to see themselves on this major video project, it's going to be disheartening when you get told, yeah, this bonehead didn't back things up, and so you're only going to be in the last four sections.
Why are you not going to just reshoot it? You just don't have the money?
I don't have the money. I don't have the time. We're on a tight schedule. I just had to. So again, it was fail fast, fail forward, fail often. I failed.
Wow.
So I'm going to fail forward and I'm going to figure out how to make do with what I've got and put out a good, it fundamentally shifted the focus of the project. The host was not going to be as major a part of the project as she is now. Yeah. And I think we're going to have a better project. I think we're going to have a better product. I'm not looking forward to having to tell that youth that we lost a lot of their tape.
Wow. Well, you talk about learning. So, like, what are you going to do differently to get the workflow right so you don't lose stuff in the future?
I have three different hard drives with copies of all the files on them right now, and they've been backed up 9 different times.
Oh my gosh! Manually, yeah. Automatically back up.
I set an automatic backup, and then I manually put them on 2 or 3 different hard drives, just so I've got a copy somewhere.
You know, that language about failing fast and failing forward and da-da-da-da-da, I feel like there's this sort of mythologizing or romanticizing of failure that happens in people who write about entrepreneurship and startup culture and that sort of thing. But, I mean, failing hurts. Failing sucks. You are on the floor in tears over this. It's not I don't know anybody. If you really care about the thing you're working on, you're not going to be like, oh, well, I guess I failed. Now on to the next thing. Like, failure really, really hurts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in the Christian story, we have this story about this guy who died on a cross, and we romanticize it, we mythologize it, but if we really understand it, it does hurt. And so I think the same thing can be said of the startup literature. I can tell when I'm reading someone or listening to an audiobook, I can tell when someone is talking about failure and they know what they're talking about, as opposed to someone who's just aping this language of failure. Because yeah, it sucks. It sucks so bad. But the cliches are right. That's how you learn. One of my staff, her husband does video for a large corporation here in Kansas City, and he's been consulting with me on this project. And when she told him what happened, his first reaction was, wow, that sucks. I feel for him. And his second reaction was, that will never happen to him again.
You will make sure that anybody you know who's doing video, it won't happen to them either, because you'll tell them.
Yeah, back it up.
Man, okay. Well, are you listening to the second season of Startup, the podcast?
I'm not.
I think you would love it. Did you listen to the first season of it?
I did, yeah. It was really, really, it was tasty. I loved it.
They're doing a different company now, and in a recent episode of it, one of these entrepreneurs started talking about what's called in entrepreneurship circles the trough of despair.
Oh, yes.
This experience of people who are trying to start a company and it's not working, and they're having problems with their staff and they're not raising money, and they just, it's not just frustration that the thing's not working. It's actually despair at, you know, your own ability, and I mean this sense of I am failing at this. I'm gonna fail for the rest of my life.
Yes, yeah, Seth Godin.
Anything.
Seth Godin talks. He wrote a book about that. Seth Godin talks about that as the dip, and his contention is that's where people stop. That is why people fail. People who push through the dip or push through the trough of despair, those are the people who win. There's only one difference between people who succeed and people who don't, and it's people who push through the dip. I'm convinced of that. I think that I have some gifts and skills. I'm not unaware of the skills that I have, but I am not a remarkably skilled person. The only difference between me and a lot of other people is that I do not fear failure and I push through the dip. That is, I will say hands down, I just work harder at this than anybody else I know.
Put some flesh on that language about pushing through the dip. I mean, is that like, what does that actually mean? It means that you don't quit the project. You're going to actually put these confirmation lessons out without the video that you lost.
Right.
What else does that actually mean?
Well, I mean, the dip changes as you get older and as you get more experienced and as you get more mature. So early on, the dip was pushing through, producing the thing, and realizing that the thing you produced was crap. Because then the next time you get into the dip on a similar project, you remember what you did that produced crap and you avoid it. And so your dip is a different kind of dip. You're hitting a brick wall on a different situation. Exactly. You're hitting a different brick wall. That's what the fail forward piece of it is. Fail fast, fail forward. You never make the same mistake twice. You don't hit that same brick wall the second time. I will never lose video again. But once you get to the place where you've produced a volume of content, and so you're kind of savvy and you kind of know what you're doing. I mean, I'm at the stage with this kind of work where I basically know what I'm doing. My dip now is more conceptual. It's more thematic. Jad Abumrad, the guy who does Radiolab, talks about this thing called gut churn, where you get to a certain point in the project and you feel like you're just going to throw up because you've got all these pieces and parts. None of them make sense. You can't figure out how to do it. A lot of pastors, especially new pastors, go through this every Saturday night when they have to preach on Sunday morning. They've got all these pieces and parts and don't know how to fit it into a sermon. That's the stuff that I'm dipping right at right now, you know, is the tape that I, with Theocademy. Yeah. Is the tape that I have good? Are the interviews good? Is Jessie as good on tape as I thought she was live? Did I give her a good script? So right now I've just got all these disparate pieces and parts. Like when I get off this call with you, I'm going to start, editing the audio and laying the audio into the video, and I'm going to start seeing what kind of pieces and parts that I have. Right now I am scared to death, and it would be easy for a lot of people to get to this point and just quit. But that's part of why you go public. I mean, one of the things that I have been so inspired by with you in this podcast is you went public. I mean, and you've explicitly said that's what you're doing. I'm going to put this out every single week. I'm going to go public with it. And so there's an expectation. I mean, I've got people writing me saying, when's confirmation starting? When's confirmation going to be done? Because I've got a class starting this fall. I've got a deadline I got to hit. So I've got to put something out. So I've got to work through that dip.
So what is the deadline?
We're saying September 1. Everything will be ready to go. You can buy September 1. And in fact, okay, so here's a special offer.
Oh, yeah. Can we get a code, an offer code? Just make one up right now.
It's even simpler than that. If you will email me, Landon@theocademy.com, theocademy.com, Landon@theocademy.com, simply put in the subject line, mailing list. I will put you on a mailing list, and when all the stuff is ready to go, we will send you, anybody who's on our mailing list at that point, we will send you a special code, and you can have the digital download of the Theocademy Confirmation Series for free.
Support for the Yo Rocco podcast. Come your favorite. Anytime, anywhere.
Awesome.
All right, I know you have to get to editing, and you've got the next, four months to September 1st? 17 episodes, each one about, what, 10 or 15 minutes?
I think 15 minutes is going to be the max here. Right now what I'm working on is putting together, it's called Rough Assembly. So I'm putting together a really rough cut so I can send it to my study guide writer so she can start pumping out study guides.
Okay, and you want to get them all done before you release any of them. You're not going to do this incrementally.
No, I want to shoot all 17 out at once, and I think we can do it. I mean, I've had an editor working with me. So a lot of the rough assembly's done. Now it's just picking the pieces and parts and putting all the pretty little doodads in and writing the music.
It's the biggest one you've done. I mean, five videos were in the first series, 12 or 13 in the second one, and 17 now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about why so many.
Well, I mean, we took a look at, so for Presbyterians, we took a look at the Book of Order, section, chapter F, section F205, the great themes of the Reformed tradition.
Yeah, okay.
And we just, we use that as our guide. If these are the great themes of the Reformed tradition, these are the things that people need to know about being Presbyterian. So we just kind of broke it out in a logical scope and sequence to run through those great themes. So we get to talk about grace, we get to talk about salvation, we get to talk about service, we get to talk about scripture, we get to talk about the Trinity, we get to talk about the Holy Spirit. I mean, it affords us a lot of different things to do.
And it's the kind of thing that people can pick and choose units. I mean, not everybody does 17 different sessions in confirmation. I don't know anybody who does that. This last year I did it with my students. We had like, I think, six. And
yeah.
one of them, just so you know, was a Theo Academy video. But it was one of the new members ones. So that was another thing. Maybe we'll talk about this on a separate conversation. But, you know, the more I've thought about confirmation, the more I've wanted it to be consistent in my congregation with what we ask adults to do for new members.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And we don't put adults through a confirmation process. We ask them to come to a new member orientation and then make a profession of faith or transfer their membership or blah, 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 whatever. And I realize it's, you know, confirmation is really well suited to that time of life and adolescence. And it's really geared towards kids who have been raised in a congregation and now are getting an opportunity to think critically about the faith they grew up with.
Right.
And that's not the case with every adult. But I did invite adults into the confirmation process this year. I had one adult for every youth in our little small group. And, you know, I don't know. It was interesting. And the video that we used, the Theo Academy video we use on the sacraments, was really relatable, both for the youth and the adults. The youth did not need sort of gimmicky, you know, goofy adolescent humor that was going to make the adults roll their eyes. They were able to kind of go toe-to-toe with the adults in a conversation about what those things mean.
Yeah, that part of our conviction is that these kids are smart. You don't have to talk down to them. And one of my beefs with confirmation curriculum, and maybe this might be something that people are yearning for when they clamored for a new confirmation series, is that this isn't seminary for young people. We don't need to tell them everything about every systematic theology out there. They need to get a good handle on what it means to be a member of the Reformed tradition and of the Presbyterian Church. Yeah. So we don't have to do any of that. Yeah, if you show the sacraments one, a lot of that same material, content-wise, you know, like with the stop sign and all that kind of stuff, I basically just copied that and kind of reworded it a little bit, but it's basically going to be the exact same content for the confirmation series.
What was awesome about it was the thing I use for my lessons is Google Slides, and I project it on a TV that we have, and I was able to embed the YouTube video right into the slide, and it worked perfectly.
Love it.
And you know, the thing for confirmation for me that's more and more important as I go on to this is that while yes, it's true that it's for young people who've been raised in the church, and we want to explain to them and give them a really, you know, thorough exposure to this is the tradition that you're claiming if you choose to become an active member of this congregation. Confirmation is not an inherently Presbyterian thing.
No.
It's you know, we sort of borrow it from other places, and every congregation does it a little bit differently. Funny, the thing for me that becomes more and more important is the kids who say no. Like,
yeah.
I feel like confirmation needs to tell those kids, look, you're a baptized member of this congregation now. If you were, you know, baptized as an infant and grown up here, and you saying no now does not mean you're not a member of the church.
Yes.
you're still a member of the church, and you don't get to just walk away at this point. We still have a claim on you, confirmation is my one chance to explicitly say that, and to tell them you're going to get another. You know, this is not the end of the conversation, right?
Right, right.
Because what often happens is kids go through confirmation, they become members of the church, and it functions as a sort of graduation from the church, and now they're done. But you know, the kid that I had in my youth ministry here that has been the most active and has stayed involved and has gone on to do stuff in the PCUSA at a national level, never joined our congregation.
Oh.
Like, went through confirmation, said no, was really actively involved in some youth stuff, not our typical youth group, but then went to college and did a thing with Presbyterian Peace Fellowship and was at General Assembly last summer. Still not a member of a Presbyterian congregation. And
you know, part of me actually wishes that that was more the case. I applaud people who don't join the church and yet are more involved in the life of what the congregation is doing than others. I had one person in the congregation I served before coming to the synod that was like that. She's like, no, this is my church, but I have no need to be a member. But I'll teach Sunday school. You know, I'll do everything. But I really have no need to do that, and I like the fact that people say no. I mean, the very first thing that we say when we start the series is we refer to the whole confirmation process as brainwashing. we say the very first thing Jesse says is welcome to brainwashing. No, I'm serious. We love the Presbyterian Church. We want you to love it too, and that's our job. Our job is to get you to teach you how to think like a Presbyterian. You don't have to, but that's what we're here to do, and so we're not going to make any bones about that. But kind of the whole thematic scope of the series is we start off with that section in Joshua where Joshua turns to the people and says, choose today who you're going to serve. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. And so we say, we're going to talk to you about this Lord that we understand. And then at the very final episode, we say, okay, here's the God we're talking about. Here's the church this God created. Now it's up to you. Is this something you want to be a part of? Is this a Lord you want to serve? If so, great. Let's move on.
I'm gonna have to edit this later. It was good. Something popped into my mind while you were talking, and now it's gone away. But I was gonna say, please tell me that you're gonna make a trailer at least with that little clip in it for these videos. Do you make trailers for the Theocademy series?
Yeah, you know, I did for the ruling elder deacon one. I did an auto tune. I didn't auto tune it. I made a beat but I couldn't figure out how to auto tune it. But yeah, I will probably make a trailer for this series. I think that's gonna be important.
That's awesome. I can't wait to see that. Confirmation is this weird thing, and I mean I love the fact that you took this on, and I'm excited to see what happened. It's confirmation for me had been, you know, having not grown up in a Presbyterian church, not having done confirmation. You know, I've done it in my present call 7 or 8 times, and every year I change something about it that's not minor, because there's still pieces of confirmation that I can't get my head around, I can't get my hands on, and it feels like this holdover sometimes from this era of institutional church that in so many other ways we're trying to move beyond and be more organic and relational, and confirmation is hard to do in that way.
Because confirmation is usually, again, I mean, I refer to it as seminary for young people for a reason. We have tried to just talk to these kids about these abstract, esoteric things, and I know pastors have done the translating work, but a lot of the curriculum just don't teach these kids rubber hits the road kind of stuff. So like when we're talking about the concept of election and predestination, which is a big Presbyterian concept, election, I mean, we acknowledge to those kids, listen, Jesse says to the camera, listen, I'm not stupid. You have never probably thought that God was not going to choose you and you were going to go to hell. That's not even a thought in your mind. But when we talk about God choosing us, here's what we mean and how it lives out your daily life. Here's the way that we think today that works.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. I expect that I'm totally going to be able to hear your voice in these, when even though it's Jesse talking.
Probably.
Having read enough of what you've written and having gently ribbed you over the years about your different sort of vocal mannerisms.
She does say folks a couple times.
Good, good. Well, I hope she can incorporate like dad gum, which you've used in this podcast even. So let me just ask you real quick. When I had you on the first time, we talked all about Go to Sleep, John Darling, and the music, and I'm just making the assumption that that has completely been on the back burner since you've been working on this.
It has been, unfortunately. I've got...
You can't do everything, Landon.
I can't do everything. I've got three more songs that I just need to release. I just need to put them out there. I actually played them for a friend of ours, Ben Mattson. I was with him a week or so ago, and he was showing me his recording setup, and I was playing him some of my tunes, and he was very affirming, and that's good because I hold his musical esteem in high regard. But
he was one-third of Jesus.
One-fourth.
One-fourth. Oh, I'm sorry. Golly.
Yes.
I'm getting
there.
So yeah, he's a Jesus Fish alum.
Yeah, he started out as the drummer, and then he and I started switching off drumming and lead vocals and rhythm guitar by the end.
Nice.
Yeah, he's really top notch. But cool. Speaking of the music, I mean, I'm gonna write the music for the Confirmation series. I'm gonna nice. Score all of that stuff. So I'm trying to bring all of my stuff to bear on this.
And as I say every week, you composed and performed them, you know, shared with me the theme for the podcast that I use. So I appreciate that, and I love it.
Thanks, man.
I have to tell you that one of the coolest things that's happened in the last couple of years here with my work with the youth is I got these three guys who are in a band, and they played at their school's Battle of the Bands, and it was their first public performance. Did I lose you?
No.
That was a weird beeping noise. Okay, their first actual gig as a band where they did these covers of Front Bottoms songs, and I was at their first gig, and I was just so proud of these kids. I was almost in tears, man. It wasn't anything to do with Sunday school or anything. They just got up and played a rock and roll show.
Didn't you send us a video clip of that? Some of us.
Yeah, I sent that. And then the other thing that happened at the at that Battle of the Bands was one of the kids from the church youth group who's grown up in the church and is this really sort of prim and proper straight A student youth who is, you know, dresses well for church, and which in Southern California is kind of a big deal if you do that. She's in a band that played at this school Battle of the Bands, and she was like thrashing her hair around. It's like, where has this person been?
I love it.
I thought you'd appreciate that. But well, have fun with the editing. Make sure to back everything up.
Yes, sir.
I look forward to seeing these in September. I, in all likelihood, will use them for confirmation.
Awesome.
Next year, and we'll gladly pay the $20 because that is a total bargain when it comes to curriculum pricing for stuff.
I'm glad to hear you say that. That's what we settled on. We thought a one-time shot, and we're gonna say it like this. You know, listen, we want to keep doing these things, so help us keep doing it. We want to release as much for free as we can. Like the stuff that Eric's working on with me, that's gonna be for free. This other series thing that I was talking to you about with the African American woman, that'll be free on YouTube.
Awesome.
But there is going to be some of these big major curriculum pieces. We just can't justify doing everything for free. So we're trying to make it as inexpensive as possible.
Well, it's that model you see in like mobile apps and lots of other things. There's a free level and a premium level. Streaming
right.
services have gone to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if it's, you know, if it's valuable, then people will pay for it gladly.
Yeah, that's my hope.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for talking to me today. I appreciate it. It's always fun. It's even more
fun.
Yeah,
man.
And that podcast idea where we listen to a song, I'm not kidding about that. Now I've seen how we could actually make it work. And there might be some copyright things. We might get sued, but I think it would be fun.
Well, and now that New Music Day is switching from Tuesday to Friday this summer, we'll have all weekend to listen to the songs. And then like early in the week, we can kind of throw songs at each other.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Great.
All right, man. Thank you, buddy.
All the best. Bye.
Bye-bye.